More unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, and maybe boy, maybe girl. Who knows if you're listening to this on a Saturday morning. I'm either very impressed or disappointed. I'm not sure which. I think impressed. But there are other things to be doing on Saturday mornings than listening to the grim economic forecasts. Hopefully I've got, this is Jake McClure. This is the personal wealth coach. And hopefully I've got Elder Baldy Jeff McClure coming up on the phone line here. Elder Baldy, are you there?
I think I am.
All right. Well, welcome to the program, Jeff McClure and Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Would you like to do the disclosures, please?
Well, I can say that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, which you've probably already figured out, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which neither approves nor disapproves what we do. That's just our regulator. In Salado, Texas. It's not that the SEC is in Salado, Texas, but the firm is in Salado, Texas. And not coincidentally, the principals in the firm happen to be Jeff and Jake McClure, or Jake and Jeff McClure, depending on your perspective. Let's see, what else is interesting? We do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid to do this radio program. It's a public service effort on our part. We do pay for advertising for the radio program.
But
why?
But so does KTEM.
Yes.
They pay for advertising for the radio program as well. So
that's, we share in the advertising costs. And that's relevant somehow. Let's see. The information that we present on this radio program is not investment advice, even though we are principals at a registered investment advisory firm. It is educational information, and you should not directly take investment positions based on anything we say on this program. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific needs, desires, objectives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we are a fiduciary investment advisory firm. We work solely for our clients, and we design individual portfolios for those clients. So if you want an individual portfolio and you are financially independent or near it, we're the people to talk to. But don't take what we say on here as investment advice. The information we present here has been obtained from sources. Oh, I love this. I get to say deem.
All right.
We deem to be reliable and consistent and good information, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to its accuracy or completeness. Yeah, that too. What else do we say? Close cover before striking. That really doesn't apply much anymore because when's the last time you saw a matchbook?
I see them semi-regularly.
You do?
Yeah. They still have them at places like restaurants and things. I haven't been to a restaurant in a while. Something about some kind of thing that's floating around in the air. I don't know. But yeah, I have seen matchbooks relatively recently. Pre-COVID, I saw them regularly.
Well, I haven't seen a matchbook in a long time. I must be going to the wrong restaurants.
Yeah. Or looking in the wrong spots.
Probably am, because they were designed to help you light cigarettes, and I haven't seen people smoking cigarettes in a while either, except on TV.
You let people smoke cigarettes on your TV? That seems
I don't
like...
let them. They just do it.
Goodness gracious.
I don't smell it. They don't pollute the air. So, but the 1950s reenactment shows that I see everybody smoking cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
Explains why the adults that were alive in 1950 are no longer alive.
That and age.
Well, we can just blame it on smoking.
Oh, yeah.
And all the rooms, and I do remember this, and all the rooms where the scenes are shot in office buildings and police departments and things like that are kind of like there's a fog in there.
Well, you can go back even farther than that, and you can prove some mortality with this. It's same kind of tongue-in-cheek as that in the mid to late 1600s, tobacco started making a pretty big presence in Europe. It was being brought back from the New World. And it was being grown and harvested in Europe, and then people were smoking it, and that's why none of them are still alive.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was wondering why they were still alive.
It's deadly. I mean, it was 100% death rate for all of them. They all died. None of them made it. It's just, it's horrible. Horrible.
Well, we can go on and talk about something that's not horrible.
All right, go ahead. Statistics are great. You can cause causation just by looking at things except for the most important parts. All right.
The S&P 500 stock index, otherwise affectionately known as SPX, turned in a reasonable week. It closed Friday at 30.3097, which is down a bit from where it's been, and it's not its recent highs, but it was up 1.86% for the week. That leaves it down 3.85% year to date and down 8.52 from its high in February. It's up over 38% from its low back in March, and it's up about 5% from where it was this time last year. That all sounds interesting. The important thing to understand about the S&P 500 at this point is it's trading in a range. The market is trading in a range, somewhere just above 3,000 to about 3,200. And it just kind of bobs up and down depending on what happens from week to week. On Friday, the market was down a bit because primarily because Apple decided to close some stores because of an increase in coronavirus infections in certain areas, which makes the market think, whoa, more coronavirus, as if it didn't already know it. Presuming that the market can think, and actually it's the consensus of all the investors who may or may not be thinking.
Yeah, it's the whole IQ of a large crowd thing. On average, it might get it right, but short term, it's probably wrong.
Well, what the market is effectively forecasting, and the market is a forecasting mechanism when it stabilizes, and it's stabilized about 3,000 to 3,200, is about a 10% loss about a year from now in earnings. In other words, if we look at corporate earnings back in what corporate earnings were expected to be back in January and February, and we look at where the market is today, it's obviously down. It's down about 8.52% from where it was in February. And in February, it was forecasting earnings a year in the future, if we assume that the market studies and the behavioral studies relating to the market are accurate. And we're saying, nope, it doesn't really mean the market has changed its mind, in effect, and says somewhere between 7.5% and 10% of corporate earnings are going to be more or less permanently destroyed. I say permanently, not to say that the market, the earnings won't go up in the future, but once the coronavirus pandemic is over, we have a vaccine, we have a treatment, corporate earnings will take about their round figures about a 10% hit. And that's probably a pretty accurate estimate. The market, when it stabilizes over the long term, the market makes some pretty good forecasts. Now, the forecasts aren't precisely accurate. No forecast is. The future is always uncertain. But the market is a consensus of what people with money to invest think is going to happen in the future.
If you don't mind, I'll throw out some science into the middle of this.
Oh, no.
I know. It's okay. Horrible. Horrible science stuff.
Get out your beakers and your colored water and start boiling it.
It's a fun scientific study. It's on gumballs. What does this have to do with the consensus in the market? Well, you know, the state fairs and the carnivals and so on, where you have this big jar full of gumballs or marbles. And if you guess the right number in the jar, you get the winnings, whatever they are, whether that means that you get a lot of gumballs, which sounds like a horrible thing to win, or you get some kind of dollar or maybe a big teddy bear or whatever. So they did research on this, and what they found is that almost everyone, and by almost everyone, there's a very, very tiny percentage, a very tiny, about to the fourth decimal point in percentages, that actually guess the number correctly. But the range of guesses are very wide. Some people guess way, way, way too much. Some people guess way, way, way too little. And you think, what are they thinking? But when you average it all together, it's within about 1% of the number of marbles or gumballs in the jar. So there's less than 1% of the people answer within 1% of the real number. But when you average everybody together, we get the right answer, or very close to it. And the market tends to do that. It takes a while, and if you think of the swinging of the market as somebody's guessing wrong, they're guessing way too high or way too low, and these markets are swinging. But if you take some time and average in all the people that are making decisions, it's a pretty good predictive device. There you go. There's your science. We can hand it back to you now.
Okay, we got a question before we get to the rest of the market. We got a question emailed in from John. Why? First we had a toilet paper shortage, now we have a meat shortage, and now a coin shortage. What's the cause?
All right. I'm prepared on this one, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
You want to do it, you can.
Well, I've got a pretty good handle on it, too, but go ahead.
There's a lot of coins out there. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of coins. We don't have a true shortage of coins. There's enough of them out there. They're just not being used. Why aren't they being used? Well, where do they traditionally get put back? You know, if you buy something at Wendy's or at HEB, you generally are not pulling out pockets of change to do it with. You're usually handing over paper. And that they are handing back coins. Well, where do the coins come back into the system? And they come back into the system in some weird places. Most of those weird places are still closed. So the coins are going out of the system into people's pockets, and they're not coming back into the system in the normal way. This creates what appears to be a shortage. But if this is a good one for you, old Elder Baldy, do you have anywhere in your house where there's a large collection of pennies and dimes and nickels and quarters that have just been gathering over the years?
Actually, no.
You used to.
I used to, but we don't anymore.
Why did you stop? What did you do to stop that?
We took them to the bank and got actual money for them because we realized that there's no real value in what we were doing.
Okay, exactly. Most of the places that you can take those coins back are not open for business in the same way that a grocery store is, or a convenience store is, or a fast food restaurant if you're driving through. So the coins are coming out of the system and not back into the system. And there are still vast numbers of people that have relatively large collections of piles of coins and quarters that are just either on nightstands or in jars or in bowls or somewhere, and it's just sitting there. Well, those collections are larger right now than they were. And it means that when you go to a fast food restaurant and you hand them paper, they're going to say, well, I can't give you coin change. There's not enough. Now, the Federal Reserve has already started the pressing machines to get the coins made again. And we're not in a great deal of danger of increasing inflation by doubling, tripling, or even times 100 the amount of coins that we have, because it's such a tiny percentage of the overall monetary supply.
Yeah, the banks are complaining that they may run out of coins in the near future, like by the end of June.
Yeah,
and conceivably the banks will run out of coins.
And I have been to multiple grocery stores that said we will not be taking paper money right now because we don't have coins to give you change. So.
And
it's a move toward this new technology of electronic money. New. Well, I'm going to put air quotes on new.
I suspect if we were to do, I haven't seen any data on it, but I suspect if somebody were to look at the dollars in circulation that are available to make change, it's falling off too.
It
boils down to the fact that the money, we can learn something that's very important here about money supply.
Yeah.
Money supply is not just the quantity of money in the system, which, by the way, in relationship to the GDP, is the highest it's ever been right now.
Right,
We've been measuring it. But we don't have inflation. As a matter of fact, we're having disinflation at this point.
Which will become deflation if it hangs around for about a year.
But this, in other words, the fact that there's a huge quantity of money supply, the M2 is way up, way up.
Oh, wait, just a second. I got to tell them what M2 is. Okay, M1, cash, bank accounts. That's it. M2 includes most money markets, CDs, basically all of the things that you or I would consider a safe cash position is M2. There.
So the quantity of money out there has increased to the, well, it's at $4.6 trillion right now, which is the highest it's ever been. In money, that's just in money market funds. And yet we have no inflation. And there, matter of fact, we're having negative inflation at this point, disinflation. The reason that the money supply is not translated into inflation and everybody being flooded with too much money to spend is because the velocity of the money has ground to the lowest level since we've been measuring the velocity of money. In other words, money's not moving around. People have liquidated stocks and they are getting more money in, and the government is supplying more money into the system. People are being paid money.
Yeah, there's a.
But they're mostly putting it in savings positions or money market funds.
LPL Research did a study this or a survey over the past 6 months. 33% of investors over the age of 65 sold all of their stocks this year.
Huh.
Which is a big change for the first 3 months of the year. Amateur investors were not selling. But coming forward through that, a lot of people have sold a lot of their stock positions, and they're sitting on cash. The savings rate in the United States is at near record levels, but it's not being spent, which means that because it's not being spent, it's sitting there. It's the same as it not existing as far as inflation and deflation goes. And let me give this a more easy to understand concept. You're a store owner and you're selling coffee cups. And the person that comes into your store looks at the coffee cups and has $10,000 in their pocket, but doesn't buy anything. Another person comes in with a dollar in their pocket and doesn't buy anything. What's the difference between the two to how you set your price? Nothing. It means that you're likely to lower your price because people are coming in and not buying. So that's disinflationary. If nobody's buying, you need to lower your prices to get people to buy it. That's simple auction rules. It's the same for any business. And just because somebody has a lot of money doesn't mean that they're spending it. It has the same effect as them having no money on your business. So disinflation can happen when people are sitting on huge hoards of money. It happened in the Depression. Became deflation. A lot of people were storing their money rather than using it because they were afraid that either the banks weren't going to be there or they wouldn't have any ability to get new money after they spent the money that they had. And that's a minor self-fulfilling prophecy. It's something that we really would like to get out of in the near future because it can have some detrimental effects for a lot of people.
One of the things is, let's go on with the market a little bit more.
Okay.
Stock market is in a trading range right now and is stable, relatively stable. I mean, when considering last week, the market moved almost 6% in a single day, that kind of stability. The level of instability that we see in this relatively stable period is higher than normal, and there's a really good reason for it. The future is always uncertain. We just are very much aware of it right now. We don't know whether there'll be a second wave in the coronavirus. We don't know if there'll be a second wave of shutdowns. Certainly hope there won't be, but there might be. We don't know if the coronavirus will surge in Texas and other places like it's doing. It's accelerating in Texas. Matter of fact, the rate of growth of the coronavirus in Texas right now is as high as it was in the country when it first started, when we were scared to death of it, shut everything down. It's growing at about 3.65% per day, which is an astonishingly huge growth rate, and that is going on across the southern states.
What percent did you say?
About 3% a day.
Okay.
And hospitalizations have doubled since the beginning of this month. In other words, we're seeing a doubling about every 20 days in hospitalizations and in new cases. Now, will that go on forever? I have no idea, and that's the problem. We don't know. We had about 1,000 hospitalizations in Texas at the beginning of the month. We're up to nearly 2,000 now.
Well, so and infection rate is about the same as that. It's double where it was at the beginning of the month. Yeah.
And so what we're seeing is the infection rate is double, the hospitalization rate is double. That's one of the reasons the market had that 5% drop when it saw it happen. But there's so much uncertainty out there as to how long this infection, this pandemic will last, how much impact it will have directly on the market, on earnings, whether we'll have a second shutdown, which would be devastating to the economy. So the market is going to swing back and forth a little bit, but it's focused on, again, the market is effectively focused on where it thinks corporate earnings will be a year from now. And that is sort of stabilized with a lot of variance in the stabilization. And just kind of get used to that. I really don't expect to see this amazing rise in the market up almost 40% from where it was in the bottom. I don't expect to see more of that kind of rise. The market is, from every aspect I see, fully priced at this point.
Right.
And so don't think it's over. It isn't over. Don't think we're going to have a continuous bull run in the market, because we're not. I don't really think we're not. I can't tell you the future.
I would say that what we're seeing in this stability, if you can call it stability, where the market's trading within a range, it's a wider range than it normally trades within when we call it stable. But it's really kind of averaged out in the same position for the last couple of weeks. It's kind of hanging out there. Mm-hmm. We call that stability, even though it's moving around day to day a pretty large amount of percentage points. It's coming back basically to where it was. That means that our consensus is not calm about it, but this is the consensus of what the market should be valued.
And the reason that it's one of the reasons it's relatively unstable, even though it's trading in this range, is, again, there are things that I think any reasonable investor would look at and say could happen. They see well within the realms of possibilities, not probable, but certainly possible, like a second shutdown of the economy and later in the year. I don't think that's going to happen. For one thing, it's an election year, and the shutdown of the economy is not a particularly popular thing to do among the people who have the power to do so. Moving on, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, now this used to be esoteric to most people, and it probably still is. The yield fell a little bit to 0.695%. It also is in a range, trading from about 0.675 to 0.750. And to put that in perspective, historically, the 10-year Treasury note has traded at a pretty fair interest rate. In other words, in the normal circumstances, I would expect the 10-year Treasury note to be yielding around 3%. Instead, it's yielding less than 1%, which we've never seen before. We've gotten used to it. But what it's saying is the Treasury, collective wisdom of people who trade Treasury notes, which are, again, a set of people with a lot of money and a lot of skin in the game, is that there will be very little or no inflation in the next year, and very little strong demand for borrowing in the economy over the next year. Now, whether that's true or not, we'll have to see. But it's certainly a fascinating thing to see this new normal pop up, less than 1% for a 10-year Treasury note. West Texas Intermediate crude oil kind of crept upward during the week. It closed at $39.57 a barrel. That's also in a trading range. It moves between about $34 and $40 per barrel. Now, that, again, is a bit of a shock. That's down 30% from where it was at the beginning of the year and where it was a year ago. So what all the markets are indicating is pretty much the same thing. They're looking at a stable future forecast. That's a conundrum. It's redundant all over again. That about a year from now, things will not be operating as fast or as hard or as well as they were before the pandemic, but the threat of financial and economic collapse from the pandemic will be behind us.
I agree completely with what you're saying. This is number one thing, and this is the same thing that we said a month ago and the month before that. The economy right now is not functioning at full. We said that a month ago. We said that 2 months ago. It was functioning at less full than it is now then. So we're coming back. We have seen the bottom of the economic impact. The worst of it is behind us as far as the jolting stop of the economy. But that doesn't mean that it's all good news from here. And that's the thing that people hear, hey, we're past the worst of the economic side. The pandemic side, we're not past the worst. And this is one of those areas where there's so much confusing information in the news because the people reporting on it are confused. When people talk about a V-shaped recovery, are they talking about the market or are they talking about the economy? Wait a minute, aren't they the same thing? No. No, it'd be kind of like saying your job is dependent on the prices of the grocery store. It doesn't have anything to do with each other unless you work at the grocery store. The economy as a whole includes all kinds of stuff that aren't in the market, or not in the publicly traded market, that is. So mom-and-pop stores, your restaurants, and the vast majority of restaurants are not publicly traded restaurants. If you just go through a list in your mind of things that are not in the market, you'll know that the economy is a lot bigger than the market. And the market isn't pricing itself based on what we're seeing in the economy right now. This is what we were saying earlier in the hour. The market is pricing itself on what it expects the economy to be later on, which is why the market looks like a V-shaped recovery, because it's looking ahead. The economy will recover based on some very important events, and these are the things that we keep repeating again and again. Number one, we don't over-infect, that we keep the infection rate down below the hospital capacity rate. Because if we fill up the hospitals, we have what happened like in New Jersey and New York. It's not good. Even in places where it's a really, really, really effective treatment method. Bell County is a great example. There's 84 people in Bell County, according to the health district. 84 people have been hospitalized ever in Bell County for coronavirus, COVID-19. How many deaths have we had? 10. Well, if you just look at that and you say about 1 out of 8 people die when they go to the hospital for coronavirus, it's a scary thing still. We're getting better, and Bell County is doing it a lot better than in a lot of other places. It's some of the top medical care in the world, and you can just look at these numbers to find that, because there's more like 1 in 3 in New York. 3 people hospitalized, 1 died. Now, that's not a good statistic. So we're doing better here, but it's still important to recognize that there's a real threat out there. And it's political season, and both sides are taking this politically. And this is shame on us, because it doesn't matter from a perspective of you or I. If I'm wearing a mask, it's not to protect me. Unless it's one of those special hospitally rated masks, an N95 mask or something above that. This mask
isn't... And you get rid of your beard.
And I get rid of my beard. This mask isn't to protect me. It's to protect the people around me. So going to a large group, not wearing my mask, is saying I don't care if you get sick. And if everybody in the group is not wearing a mask, we're all saying we don't care if anybody else gets sick. If you're wearing your mask you're just keeping your germs close to yourself. It's more like the surgeon in the operating room. They're the ones wearing masks, not the patient. We're the ones wearing masks because we don't want to get each other sick. We don't want to get our germs into everybody else. And that's not political. That's just hygiene. I have made fun of people in the vast continent of Asia for a long time for walking around with those silly masks on their face. Well, I'm doing it now, and sure, I'll make fun of myself doing it. Why am I doing it? Because I understand economics. I don't understand medicine. But I understand if we can keep this thing toned down, the economy's going to recover faster. That's not maybe. That's for sure. If we keep the infection rate down while we're opening the economy will open up better. This is not rocket surgery. This is really simple stuff. So why turn this into a statement on politics? And both sides are doing it. They're doing it at different levels, at the national level, at the city level. And when I say both sides, I mean Democrats and Republicans. It's an election year, and there's no holds barred. Nobody is saying don't wear masks. That makes me happy. But if they're saying it's optional if you come here, well, what I would tell you is if you came to my house and you're a friend of ours, I would ask that you wear a mask for a while. I know that's really intrusive. But why don't you wear a mask and we'll wear a mask and we'll... I don't want to get my friends sick. And I don't want them to get me sick. This week we had a little self-isolation issue where someone that I know and was near this last weekend went to go get tested because they were showing symptoms. Now, it came back negative, but I had to, for a day and a half, go to self-isolation because I didn't want to get any of my office staff sick. Well, what does that mean? It means that businesses get shut down, not because the people in the business are sick, but because they're afraid to get people in the business sick because somebody that they know might have been sick. We have to be careful about this.
This is all pretty unreal to most of us because even though we've had 10 people die in the county and we've got 80-some people that have been hospitalized, most of us don't know any of those people simply because there's the number of people in the county versus the number of people who were hospitalized.
There's a couple of 100,000 people in the county, and there's 85 people that have been hospitalized, 716 people that have been sick.
The problem with this way of dealing with things, which I think is what's going on, because I went out last week and had to go to the UPS store and go to some other places. And when I walked into the UPS store, for example, in Belton, there were quite a few people going in and out of the UPS store, and there were quite a few people in that area. I was the only person wearing a mask. And people were not keeping their distance. They were clustering together, standing in line, acting like there was no coronavirus. Here in Salado, I've seen people, crowds of people doing exactly that same thing. The problem is that none of them know anybody who's gotten sick or died. So it's not, they don't sense the threat personally, they don't sense the threat emotionally. The problem with that, rather than looking at the numbers, is this doubling every 20 days. By the time you know somebody who has gotten sick,
you may already be sick.
You could be sick. A lot of work has been done on who is transmitting the disease, and the largest transmission rate is from people who are in the process of coming down with COVID-19 and don't know it yet. They are largely asymptomatic. They're very contagious. They don't have a fever yet. Their heart rate is up a little bit. They haven't really started coughing much yet. And as they start to cough, they don't know that.
Yeah, it's a little weak, but it could be virus. It could be allergies. They don't have
a cold.
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
And that's the people who are doing the transmission, and they can do it by talking, singing, just breathing, if they're breathing hard, particularly in a closed area. And that's the value of having the mask on, is it tends to contain those tiny water droplets that have the little micro water droplets that are coming out of your mouth, particularly when you're talking or singing. It tends to contain them next to your mouth rather than spread them in the air around you. And I'm frankly concerned, because what we're seeing here is the same spread, the same infection rate, and the same lack of concern about that infection rate that we saw in New York City just before they had the big surge, that we saw in Wuhan, that we saw in Italy. We're seeing people who are convinced that there's no real danger, and they're not behaving like there's a danger. But it's picking up speed, and by the time we realize how serious it is, it's really very difficult to get it stopped then at that point.
Yeah. And I think the most important thing I can say out here, wear your seatbelt. Do you know anybody whose life has been saved by a seatbelt? Has your life been saved by a seatbelt? Probably not. Most people don't know anybody who's been saved by a seatbelt. And most people have never been saved by a seatbelt. But believe it or not, I don't wear my seatbelt because I'm afraid of getting a ticket. I wear my seatbelt because it's a very small thing. It doesn't cost me almost anything to do. And in the event that I need it, it might very well save my life. If it's about wearing a mask, it's the same thing. It might very well save someone's life. Not mine. This mask will not save me. But it might save somebody else. Well, I'm okay with that. I will do that. I will be, it's a thing that I do for the people around me, and I would really like it if they would do it for me too, because I really don't want to be breathing them right now. And man, if we were having this conversation last year at this point, we would be considered germaphobes, hypochondriacs. You carry hand sanitizer around in your pocket and you're wiping your hands down every time you touch a door. Well, yeah, I am.
By the way, we're not saying wear a mask for any political reason at all. There's no politics in it at all of any kind.
Absolutely not. And it isn't a statement of negativity against anybody. In fact, it's a statement of positivity. I think if you're going to the Trump rally in Tulsa today, if you're listening to this, it's probably online, I think you should wear your mask. It's an optional thing, and they're giving you a mask and hand sanitizer at the door. Do you want to get the president sick? Do you want to get some other high-level official sick? Wear your mask. Don't do it because it's some kind of negative. It's you're trying to protect the person that you're there to support. If you're out in a protest march to go against something else, wear your mask. Well, who would you get sick if you're protesting without a mask? Well, the people that are protesting with you are the ones that are going to get sick. So it just makes sense. If you're at the rally and you're asymptomatic, but you're coming down with it and you're screaming slogans, it's the same as singing. You're putting out a lot of air, and you're going to be sucking air in at the same time everybody else is. Wear a mask. It's not comfortable.
It's going to make the slogan shouting a lot more muffled.
Yeah, it will. And it's not as fun. But you may be protecting the people that share your beliefs. And that's an important thing. And we're not coming at this as a negative. And unfortunately, it's becoming this thing of we don't have to wear it because of this or. And this isn't all from the Republicans or the Democrats. I'm seeing enough of it from both sides. Democrats tend to say it less, but this is, again, a demographic issue, not a right versus left issue. It's Democrats tend to be from urban areas. That's highly populated centers, and that's where diseases strike hardest, and that's where they have already struck hardest. Now it seems to be spiking in places that are less urban, which means that the people that live in less urban areas, in the rural and suburban areas, need to take some notes from the people in the urban areas and say, all right, this makes sense. I'm going to wear a mask for a while. And I know that's hard because if you're a very conservative Republican, you don't want to take advice from a Democrat, a liberal. But this isn't from a Democrat, a liberal. Take it from the medical community. The liberals just learned from it, and they may be spouting off about how it's the best thing in the world. Just listen to the doctors. And that makes sense to me. And the president has said repeatedly he doesn't mind if you wear a mask. So do it. That's what I would say. And why are we harping on this again and again? Because this is the single greatest threat to our economy right now. If we're talking about how is the market going to do in the future, how is the economy going to do in the future, my first statement is wear your mask. Because that's how we get recovery. That's how we get profitability. It's really hard to run a profitable business if all your employees are sick or just occasionally sick or carrying symptoms of being sick for a long period of time. This is not politics. This is business. So let's get to business and be safe. If I see If I run a welding shop and I see somebody welding without their goggles or mask on, I'm going to tell them, put your stinking goggles and mask on because you're going to go blind, and I'm not going to make any money from you welding if you're blind. And I realize that's a very selfish way of looking at it. I would do it because I like the employee as well. But come on, you got to be reasonable here. Health standards are important. And I
Speaking
think
of things that are important,
yeah,
we need to do some commercials.
You read my mind. This is going to be an interesting commercial. We'll see what happens because it looks like they were moving it around while I was looking at it a minute ago remotely. We're going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone lines are all taken up, but you can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we will answer those questions, or at least attempt to. All right, so we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back
with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Man, this is it's fun to work with these knobs and dials. And I am hearing in the background from you some radio.
It went away.
Okay. All right.
You're hearing the past.
I hear the past. Okay, so it is gone. I guess you were just listening online?
I was.
Yeah, there's a little lag there. Yeah. All right, so a lot of stuff happening right now. There is a change, and we mentioned this at the last, very, very last part of the last hour last week, that the Paycheck Protection Program has changed. The Senate and the House passed and the President signed a change to the Paycheck Protection Program. What is that? If you're a business owner and you got an SBA loan that may be forgiven, you had to spend 75% of that on your payroll. Well, that's now been lowered. It's been lowered to 60% because a lot of people were looking at not being able to pay rent. And if they had to concentrate all that money on payroll, they were going to lose the fact that they were going to lose their restaurant or lose their business because they couldn't pay rent with that money if they wanted it forgiven. Or they were just going to have to pay interest on it. Well, the Congress listened. I know that's weird. We're living in weird times where Congress is actually paying attention occasionally. But it's down to 60%. So if you've spent 60% in the allotted time period, you'll get a forgiveness. And that's fantastic for business owners. I've been talking to several business owners who early on had to lay people off before the PPP came out. They looked around and they said, we got to get out of this position. We can't be paying people when there's no money coming in. And then PPP came out. Well, they hired people back, but they already missed a couple of paychecks. And now you got to figure out some way of making up for that. Well, they've done it now. So at 60%, it's much more reasonable and much easier to meet that standard. So that's a big piece of news. Do you have
another piece
something?
Of news about the PPP? The Congress has been pushing the Treasury Department, Small Business Administration, to publish the names, addresses, amounts, and a lot of in detail.
Very personal stuff, yeah.
On any business or company or person who received more than $150,000, and they're going to do it. They didn't say when they're going to do it, but they're actually going to put out a list, which I think is frankly absurd, publicly list everybody who took the loan. That's basically giving away a lot of business data. If it's below $150,000, they're not going to give you, they're just going to give it by zip code. They're going to say this much was allocated to the zip code and this one to another. So if you have a business and you had more than $150,000 loan, they're going to publish it.
And I think that is a gross violation of privacy. If a bank did the same thing, they would be breaking the law. It'd be illegal for the bank to say, these are the businesses that we've given loans to without the permission of that business. Now, there's some differences. Obviously, the SBA loan could be forgiven. But they're not saying that they're going to tell everybody the forgiven portion. They're saying that they're going to tell everybody who got the loans. which seems a little bit extreme, in my opinion. Go ahead.
Okay, can you go ahead?
I was going to say, it's a decent way of policing to make sure people aren't abusing the program, to have society all turn and point fingers, but it's only a decent way of policing if you think, like, the scarlet letter is a good punishment, where you're being shamed by people around you. Popular opinion changes very quickly. When there was not enough money in the PPP program and large businesses were taking loans, there was a lot of shaming, saying, hey, this was meant for small businesses. Well, Congress passed another extension and added more money to it. There's still a lot of that money sitting in the coffers waiting to be loaned out. So it's not like if you got the loan, you were taking it out of the mouth of somebody else at this point.
So I think it's really...
So public opinion changed. Go ahead.
Congress wrote a law.
Mm-hmm.
The loans were then distributed according to the law that Congress wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress says people cheated by following the law we wrote.
Yep.
So we want to know who cheated.
I don't know that that's weird. I think that just sounds like Congress. It's Congress.
That old thing we've said before, the difference between pro and con can be seen in the difference between Congress and what's the opposite of progress. Obviously, it's Congress.
It's Congress. Yeah.
But I got some good news, sort of. Same kind of good news we have on the other things. We normally pay a lot of attention to the conference board's leading economic index.
Oh, yeah.
And it's composed of the leading economic indicators, and it tells us where we'll be in the future normally. In this case, it gave no warning that the coronavirus was coming, which is not too surprising. In a sense, though, it did. It dipped into negative territory several times in the last year. Matter of fact, a year ago it was negative, and it warned a recession is coming, and we got the recession now.
Yeah. What that means is that just like we were saying for the last 2 years that we were due for a recession in 2020, we didn't think that we were due for a pandemic in 2020. Though if we look at history, it seems like we were about due for a pandemic. I don't think there's somebody with a calendar saying, all right, release the germs. It's just something that happens occasionally in history.
Yeah, it's just weird that we almost exactly 100 years ago we had another major pandemic. But the reason I wanted to bring out the leading economic indicators, now they dropped over the last 2 months. In March and April, they dropped about 14% total, which is a huge drop in leading economic indicators. The concurrent economic indicators dropped about the same amount.
By the way,
coincident.
We got to throw this in here. Concurrent is a really fancy way of saying current.
Actually, it's coincident, but it means at the same time.
Right. So if you really want to be fancy for no particular reason, like you think you might want to be an economist, you should use concurrent. It's just
right.
Great.
People or coincident.
Or coincident. Or if you really, really, really want to get out there and be fancy sounding, you can say the concurrent coincident indicators, which is redundant and repetitive, but it sounds fancy.
But you could also talk about the lagging economic index.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
But
that doesn't tell you anything about the future, though.
The important thing about the leading economic indicators is they actually came up in June. When we say in June, it was released on the 18th, and we actually saw a small 2.8% increase. Now, 2.8% against 14 tells you that we've lost about 14. The leading economic indicators have lost about 14%, and they've gained back about 2.8. It's very much like what's going on in the labor market, where we added about 2.5 million jobs, which sounds really impressive, until you also realize that we have about 20 to 30 million people who became unemployed as a result of the coronavirus. 2.5. At least we're not falling any further. And that's basically what the leading economic indicators are saying, too. Matter of fact, across the board, all the indicators that we use to say where is the economy going over the next year are saying the same thing very consistently. We hit bottom. We hit a bottom, hopefully the bottom, in May. And we're sincerely hoping that it will be all uphill from here. And the uncertainty is, of course, if we get swamped by the viral infection again and the hospitals start to fill up, we'll have to shut the economy down again.
Well, the
Otherwise,
question
we'll
is
bodies in the streets.
Unlikely that we'll do that at this point. And we're about out of time for this hour.
Yep.
When we say it's unlikely, we're now in a political season.
If we hit the point where the hospitals start to fill up, though, and we see what we saw in New York, where people, where they're actually having to
mass graves,
coffins in refrigerator trucks, I think we could see another economic shutdown.
Yeah.
I hope we don't do that. I sincerely hope we don't do that. It's entirely up to us.
It's our own behavior that leads us to that. Yeah.
And we're out of time for the hour.
Yeah. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
All right. You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to recordings of the radio program going back quite a ways. We're going to be having podcasts up on the major networks in the near future. You can read our philosophy, contact us through the form, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we do read those things. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.